Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's very special episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Leila Latif. We're coming to you live from the London Film Festival where we recorded this. First up, there's The White Lies with David Jenkins and Hannah Strong talking about their top LFF picks. Then we had three very exciting and very cool filmmakers coming to join us to talk about their films that are also going to be showing at the festival. First up, there was Horde, in which 7-year-old Maria and her mother live in their own loving world, built on sorting through bins and collecting shiny rubbish. One night, their worlds fall apart, and we join Maria a decade later, living with her foster mother. There was also In Camera, which follows Aiden, a young actor who is in a cycle of nightmarish auditions. After he receives many multiple rejections, Aiden takes it upon himself to find a new part to play. And finally, there was Ha. Jeff is stranded in Budapest, and so spends a day reckoning with past and present lovers, as well as in a strange family. So I hope you enjoy the show. It was a really fun one to record, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
Should I just quickly say what's happening here, just so people know?
Just so I know.
Yeah, I don't know. So welcome, everyone. This is a as advertised, live podcast recording of a special Truth and Movies that we're doing in partnership with London Film Festival. And it's in our gallery space that they've lovingly given us, that where we've got a little exhibition going on. And the way that we're going to do it today, it's live in that we're recording it live, but it's not being transmitted live. So, you know, and the way we're going to do it is for the first sort of 15 minutes or so, we're going to just have a little general chat about the London Film Festival and what we've seen and what we're seeing, and give a few sort of personal recommendations. And then we're going to invite some filmmakers up, and me and Hannah are going to shuffle stage left, and Layla is going to take up the reins there and have a sort of more bit more of a sort of lengthy, in depth and hopefully hilarious panel discussion.
I'll try.
But yeah, over to Layla.
Yeah, welcome. This is very, very exciting. You know, being part of London and being part of like the London Film Festival, there's such a lot to celebrate at the moment. There's so many exciting debuts that have happened this year, and we've just got a really stacked group of people to, you know, to come and talk to us about their movies, but also I'm very excited to talk to you guys about like all the other stuff that is happening. I guess I should do my regular intro. Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Hannah Strong.
On the show this week, we're coming to you live from the London Film Festival. We are in a beautiful space in the Oxo Tower in the gallery, where we can see all 100 issues of Little White Lies being displayed on the walls. I have my favourites. I won't say which because I don't want to pick between my children, but every single one I genuinely,
all of them are amazing.
All of them are
every
amazing.
Single one. We have never put a bad film on the cover.
All of them are amazing. One of the things that Little White Lies claims to be is the world's most beautiful film magazine, and it's not even close, is it? It's like a selection of things.
Can I just say, I can't remember who it was, but
the Guardian said that.
Somebody else said that.
Yeah. The Guardian called us
that. We're not making that claim.
Well,
that would be
if people would like to say that, then we welcome the feedback.
We believe it, but we don't make it.
Well, I, you know, even as a freelancer who has many kind of split loyalties, I'm able to say that is assured as a title. So David and Hannah are going to be sharing some of the highlights from the absolutely wonderful London Film Festival, and then we're going to be joined by three of the festival's most talked about up-and-coming filmmakers. We've got Horde's Luna Carmoon, Ha's Ben Hecking, and In Camera's Nikash Khalid. David, do you want to go first? Celluloid Underground, I believe, was your first pick.
Yes, I'd love to talk about this. This was a film I don't think people listening to this podcast will get a chance to see this because it's already played in the festival, but that doesn't mean that I shouldn't talk about it and maybe hopefully get them to keep an eye out for it when it appears elsewhere. But it's a film by the Iranian filmmaker Ehsan Koshbat. It's like a documentary, and it's really intriguing. It's a very personal film. Ehsan grew up in Iran just after the revolution, and pre-revolution there was a kind of thriving film culture in Iran. Although, you know, restricted in some ways, like the kissing scenes were edited out of films. Just to keep the kind of moral standards of the nation high. And
TikTok would approve.
Indeed. What happened was when a film had finished its run in the cinemas, the actual celluloid, the reel, was delivered to a kind of film executioner with a literal axe who would chop it up. Because I think that was very much a kind of... it had to be something quite sort of physical and, you know, proof that it had been, like, you know... The celluloid's been chopped, it can't be used anymore. Even though you could, you know, someone could probably splice it back together again. But it turned out there was this guy. So when the revolution happened, there was a hope that things would be more liberal and there would be a more kind of openness to Western culture. But that was the opposite happened. And actually, like, ownership of films was largely banned, according to the film. And the film is about Ehsan's encounter with a guy who he's at university. He runs this film club, and he has this encounter with a guy who says, "Oh, I've got loads of films on film on celluloid." And he's like, "Oh my god, I can't believe it! Like, we've had to be showing things off of like battered VHS and whatnot." And he's like, "Oh, I'll send you some. Like, I'll smuggle them in some bags of rice, and you can show them at your film club." And it turns out that this. So he goes to meet this guy eventually, and it turns out that the guy has like. A couple of like basement, like really, really dingy basement flats in Tehran, full of film cans. Where he and it turns out that he has been a kind of very surreptitious, almost sort of like you just he was grabbing the films before they were chopped and keeping them and
saving them.
And saving them, yeah. And that and it's it, and the film is about Ehsan's own sort of cinephile awakening and being in this world, being surrounded by the, you know, a near complete history of like, you know, early Hollywood cinema, silent cinema, Russian, Japanese, like Asian cinema, like all the films that had kind of played in Iran, and kind of not being able to do anything with them, not being able to take them out of this basement, but having this tiny little cinerola machine. I can't remember what they're called, the things that you feed the celluloid through, just watching all these films. So, and this is the doc. I've kind of told you the story, but I think telling the story is kind of recommendation enough for the film. And it's got loads of amazing, like Ehsan's actually the artistic director of Bologna Il Cinema Ritrovato Film Festival, which is a festival based on like vintage archive films and restorations. And he's just got incredible, his taste is impeccable. You've got these clips from Iranian films from like pre-revolution time that are just like spine-tinglingly amazing. And you think, oh my God, there's this whole world of films that have yet to be properly kind of rediscovered. And he's kind of giving you little tasters of them from what he was learning when he was growing up. So... yes.
Sold.
Packed a lot in there, sorry.
Hannah, I mean, less of a kind of like lower profile title. Yeah, there's this film called Poor Things that I've heard is like reasonably good.
Yeah, you know it's good. We had the fortune of seeing it just before we went to Venice and are both very invested, I think, in this film. Doing well. That makes it sound like we're shareholders. We're not shareholders.
We're just shareholders in horny babies coming to screen in weird ways. Yes,
I bought stock in Yorgos. He is my like racehorse, and I'm betting it all on him. No, yeah, I've seen this film twice now. It's just like, for those who aren't aware, I'm sure that a lot of people listening will be, but it's this kind of Frankenstein story about a young woman who dies by suicide and is brought back to life by this mad scientist who's literally called God. And he trans plants the brain of her unborn child into her body in order to resurrect her. And it's a kind of like a coming of age story of her rapidly cycling through her development, I guess, intellectually, and kind of discovering the world. And I was very excited about this one, having read the incredible novel it's based on, and being a long time Yorgos Lanthimos fan. I think he's just such a wonderful filmmaker, and I didn't disappoint. I'm so glad that it's showing at London Film Festival, because I think it is, I mean, it sounds like really like wanky cinephile thing to say, but like it's just really want to see it in the cinema, because it is like it's spectacle, it's big and bold and beautiful and weird and delightful, and it has this incredible like discordant sound design, and it's just like exactly what I want when I go to the movies with a big audience. I want to kind of have that like falling in love experience. And I spoke to Yorgos in Venice, and he said about the film and about the this character of Bella Baxter, he said we all fell in love with her whilst we were making the film, and I just thought that's such a sweet thing to say about a character that you're telling the story about. And yeah, it feels very special to me, the parasocial relationship with Poor Things, but I'm excited that so many people are going to get to see it here and get to talk about it and have that same like romance that I have very much had with this film.
No, it's a very special one. I mean, not to go to kind of inside cinema, we did have friends that were kind of working on it far in advance, and they were telling us like, we think people might hate this one.
Yeah, no, they were like, there's going to be so much discourse. And actually, yeah, it's been kind of great seeing people embrace it and embrace this like young woman who is going on this like quite, I mean, in some places, very dark journey. You know, she's learning kind of what it is to be a woman in the patriarchy, in kind of this repressive atmosphere that like challenges the idea of like female sexuality and female wanting, just generally kind of like wanting a career, wanting to do things with your life, wanting to see the world. And yeah, it's that kind of like, you know, thematic side of things is really beautifully illustrated, but also just for a kind of craft nerd, like the craft of the film is so exquisite. And obviously anyone that's seen Yorgos Lanthimos' previous films like knows he's very much like, he picks a team who know their shit with regards to costume design, production design, everything. But everything in it is just so imaginative and so kind of exciting visually. It really is like feast for the senses. Has been kind of like really, you know, it's one of those like cinephile terms that you get banned from putting in reviews because everyone uses it, but it really is like, even having now seen it twice, there's so many just like delicious little details I want to dig into. And I always find with his films, like with The Favourite, I had this, and with Poor Things, the costume design is just like everything I aspire to be in my life. I'm not, but I wish I could be. I wish I could wear the outfits that Emma Stone is wearing in this film.
Well, a lot of shears, so that would be quite risque. David, what about Baltimore? And that was your next pick.
Baltimore, yeah, that's a film by two Irish filmmakers, Joe Lawler and Christine Molloy, starring Imogen Poots, and it's a kind of biopic thriller about a woman called Rose Dugdale, who I guess she was slightly a fringe figure within the sort of story of the Troubles, and kind of fascinating in that she was born as a kind of home county's English heiress who would, you know, be was taught like fox hunting and all sorts of kind of blue blood activities when she was growing up, and then had this kind of class realization and just, you know, very quickly decided to like would sort of despised herself and her family, and wanted to, you know, remove herself from her, you know, wanted to sort of like get as far away from her class as possible. It was a kind of disease that she was trying to sort of excise, and in doing so she went on a kind of Marxist training course in Cuba, and then came back and decided she wanted to dedicate herself to the cause of the IRA after seeing the Bloody Sunday massacre on TV. And this film is about an episode in which she masterminds an art heist at a big stately home in County Wicklow. And it's a bit like, there was a film that came out earlier in the year called How to Blow Up a Pipeline, which was a kind of, you know, eco-terrorist procedural film. And this is very similar film about like looking at Rose Dugdale, but looking at the kind of minutiae, the kind of moral minutiae of activism and, you know, what this process actually entails. Like, it shows the sort of this heist as being rather grim and depressing at the end of the day. Like, you know, you've got these kind of older posh people who you're kind of having to sort of yell at, who don't know what's happening. And the filmmakers I'm constantly interested and inspired by their films. And I think this is something a little bit more kind of like, I mean, I guess like their films in the past have been more of the sort of arty end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're sort of really influenced by like Antonioni and things like that. But this one is a bit more of a kind of, it's more of a sort of straight thriller, but with lots of like jagged edges. And yeah, Imogen Poots, who I'm always a big fan of. She's sort of someone I'm like, she's always good, even if the film's bad, which is quite regular.
That's such a messed up compliment, but
it's better than being always bad, even if the film's good.
Yeah, which is what we were saying Lily James was earlier.
put her on blast.
Hannah, so once people have gotten past that kind of grim and depressing tale, Chicken Run 2 is what you suggest.
Let's fucking go. I'm really outing myself as a hardcore cinephile in this podcast. Chicken Run is a very, very near and dear film to me. It's the first film I remember seeing at cinema. I was on a beanbag at the Sheffield showroom and I cried like a baby. I was a baby, but like, I was so viscerally upset by Chicken Run. I refused to eat meat for 10 years. And then I moved to Germany and couldn't not eat meat because they didn't know what vegetarian was. It's been a long time coming. They've been working on this film forever. It's not without its kind of controversy. Obviously, I think that justice for Nadia and the kind of recasting of an iconic chicken role in Ginger has upset me, but I'm very excited to see kind of where we pick up with the gang. It's been billed as a kind of James Bond-esque take on things. Obviously, the original Chicken Run was a kind of great escape riff. I just love what Aardman do. I think they're kind of, we've been talking about British filmmaking, I think they're one of the great British exports. And I'm jazzed. My mum has chickens, so I'm excited to go home and report to them about their countrymen and, you know, give them some tips on smashing the patriarchy. She named two of them after Chicken Run characters, so like, it's heavily invested in this for me.
Well, I truly believe that there is no such thing as a guilty pleasure. We should just take our pleasure.
No, I'm not guilty about it. Not at all. Pure pleasure.
Yeah, pure pleasure for Chicken Run. David, but you're next with a slightly heavier title again. I do feel like there's a strange kind of theme erupting. David, Evil Does Not Exist.
Evil Does Not Exist. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Tell that to the chickens.
So that's a new film by Risuki Hamaguchi. I'm probably massively mispronouncing that, I'm afraid. But the director of Drive My Car, which went surprisingly almost all the way to Oscar glory, which is...
Again, down with faint
wild
praise.
No, that's not faint praise.
Almost all the way.
It's surprising because the film's good. Dissing the Oscars, not the film.
Great film.
it's his new film. It was made... The soundtrack was made first, and he basically wrote the film inspired by the soundtrack. It's a kind of... A sort of like almost folk horror-y thing where you have a group of people living in the countryside, very, very attuned to nature and the land and water and the animals and welfare and all that. And then you've got this like glamping company who want to like build a glamping campsite right in the middle of it. And
advertising company that want to build a glamping
well
campsite.
Yeah, so they're a talent agency.
Talent agency, sorry. And you're something like absurd,
but yeah, it's like they're a talent agency and they want to, they basically as a scheme to get hold of pandemic funds, they're building a glamping concern. And it's about the tension that arises from these two very kind of conflicting types of people. And it's really like, yeah, it's a very tense film. Like, I think you guys are supposed to see it in Venice.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. I found it like very, I mean, just completely compelling and like really sort of in just watching these like awkward conversations between like the city and the country folk, but it's done in a way that was quite fresh.
I've never been more invested in the outcome of a town planning meeting.
Well, yeah, there was
a very long conversation about drains. Yeah, it's really good.
If you love septic tanks, this is the thing, and the placement thereof. You will love this film. But then it has it's a really great film, and then it has this like wowzer ending, which I think you're getting the kind of the first 90 minutes, which everyone can just agree on as being great, and then you get the last 20 minutes or so, which everyone can be like fighting about. So yeah, that's my take.
Well, yeah, I will be on the right side of history in that fight. I will not divulge which side I will be on. I mean, pro. I mean, I'm not. I have
guys. What if evil did exist? That's kind of the title card made me laugh a lot, because it comes in like really slow and it's like evil does exist, and then the knot comes in and I was like, ooh.
Not since Evil Dead Rise, my thoughts came out of the lake, have we seen such a reminder that evil does exist. Finally, Hannah, you wanted to talk to us about Sky Peels.
Yeah. I another British debut. This one's by Moin Hussein, and it was another Venice premiere that I saw and left me in floods of tears, which you wouldn't expect from a film about motorway service stations, or maybe you would, I don't know, people's experiences of the M65. But yeah, it's about this young man who works the night shift in a burger bar at a motorway service station, and he receives news that his estranged father has passed away, and it's kind of like him unpacking that and kind of trying to deal with who his father was and kind of why their relationship was the way it was, and also just kind of dealing with a lot of upheaval in his life. And I've got a real kind of investment in films that are in some manner like neurodivergent coded. Wow, that was a mouthful. And this for me is like one of the most kind of interesting but also like accurate portrayals of like how it is to move through the world as a neurodivergent person, and on top of that how we deal with grief. And as someone who, my dad is alive but I haven't seen him in a very long time, I found that kind of like sadness and guilt and mystery was really like kind of got me right in the heart. And yeah, I just think it's really beautiful, really imaginative film, and really wanted to give it a shout out so people can kind of keep an eye on that. And I believe it's still yet to show at this festival, but also will very likely be out in the kind of coming year, so keep an eye.
I don't know what day it is. I'm after all of these festivals.
It's only day three of the festival. We're already like, oh, I've been here 1,000 years. But
it's an enviable thing that it's just like there's so much great stuff out there that you just exhaust yourself because you want to take in all of it and have every conversation and then dissect it for hours and hours afterwards. But yeah, thank you both so much for giving us some LFF highlights and recommendations. I mean, a very, very worthy group of films, and yeah, excited to talk to some more exciting filmmakers. So yeah, I'd like to welcome to the front, we've got Hordes, Luna Carmoon, Haas, Ben Hecking, and in camera is Nikash Khalid. Welcome, welcome.
Hello.
I love how we really don't look like we've picked a dress code at all.
No.
So yeah, in the spirit of Little White Lies 100th issue, one of the things that we did was we asked a lot of incredible filmmakers about like what their origin story was. What was the moment where they decided that they needed to make movies? I mean, what are your origin stories?
Scooby-Doo. Banger. Yeah, it's the 2002 version. I remember seeing that when I was like 7 and being like...
Well, it's a shame because they cut out all of the gay stuff from that one. I think
I watched it recently and it's like, it's a quite risky film. It feels like a film about friendship under late capitalism, but I think I view everything through that lens.
Yeah. Wow, you've made me want to go and see Scooby-Doo again.
It seems like a quite like adult film.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's very sexy, actually.
Yeah.
Sexy.
It is surprisingly sexy, yeah.
She pulls her face and it just stretches out. That did something
to me.
Are
we talking about the one with that lot? That were
Sarah
rabid.
Michelle Gellar. Yeah.
I mean, that's the best casting of all time, too.
This is not where I thought this was going to go. I thought we were going to have a lovely story about, like, an aunt who bought you, like, a little camera.
I mean, I do love to bring the low culture. I just feel like, you know.
No, fair enough. Actually, looking back, that film did stuff to me as well. Ben, what about you?
I did watch Cruel Intentions at the same time as
I think Sarah Michelle Gellar is the origin story for a lot of stuff for many people.
So mine was actually Paul Simon, as in the musician Paul Simon, on Graceland. There's a song, and I can't remember the name of the song. But there's a line in it where he says, "I met you at the cinematographer's party," and I was like, oh, "Cool, cinematographers—they have parties. I'm gonna. What is a cinematographer?" And that is genuinely, I kind of thought, okay, I want to be a cinematographer and have parties. So that was my thing. But I also grew up in the countryside, and there was nothing to do. And I'm a lot. I'm quite old actually now, but. It used to be that you could get from like 6 o'clock in the morning on BBC Two to about 6 p.m. on Channel Four, just flitting between the two channels, watching old films. So, as a totally unsporty 11 to 15-year-old, I basically spent every Saturday in my bedroom just watching old films, old black and white films. So, and that was kind of it, really. And then I'd go on the Sunday, I'd go out into the countryside and reenact the storylines and stuff like that. So I just kind of, yeah, that was it basically.
What were you reenacting?
I don't really know, to be honest with you. I sort of, you know, it'd be like, I mean, Where Eagles Dare was like a firm favourite of mine, Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood, and I used to like pretend that I was storming a, you know, castle full of Nazis. I mean, it was a bit of an Indiana Jones style kind of childhood, I guess, really. It was just, you know, I mean, everybody needs to have that, I think, in their life, you know. Kill some Nazis, right? I don't know. I mean, this feels like a controversial... No, it's not a controversial thing. It's absolutely not a controversial thing. All right, yeah, I'm just going to shut up now.
The surprising pro-being kind to Nazi take that we didn't expect.
Like, okay, skinny Nazis.
Luna, what about you?
I have a few. My nan was a weird woman, and on like hot summer days, she would just make me watch like American TV movies. Like a lot of them, I'm chasing like Sybil with like Sally Field, and just VC Andrews kind of. Yeah, a lot of White Whales I'm chasing, and then constantly just like eating film from a young age, and then not really realising until I was like 14 and I was in school. And this girl came into who was in my drama class, and she was like, I just found this film on the dark side of YouTube, and this girl has sex in a bathtub. And I said, what's the name of it? And she was like, Doom Generation. And I bumped drama, and I went home and watched Doom Generation on YouTube, and just kept spiralling through the film canon that is just disgusting, sickly movies that I just kept watching on the dark side of YouTube, along with like probably like what's the American TV? Jerry Springer, like just mad. Yeah, My Baby's Got Three Pacifiers. Does anyone remember that YouTube video? Yeah, that's sad. That's how I got into film.
Yeah, no, I feel like I'm weirdly connected to all three of these stories. I was watching Graceland as a kid. I was also very into Sarah Michelle Gellar. And yes, weirdly, there were some dark spirals that involved Jerry Springer at the time. But, like, not to... I mean, your films are about so much. They encompass so many things. But, like, elevator pitch, what would you say that your films are about? Do you want to go first, Nicole?
I don't know. I'd say it's a kind of horror film about neoliberal representation politics. Or a young artist navigating late capitalism. But that's not very, like, sexy, is it? I need to make it sexier.
Well, it depends what you're into.
It does. Someone's going to be into that.
Cut the mics off.
Ben, what about you?
I want to say something that is equally as intelligent as that, but I don't think I can come up with anything. I suppose really it's about grief and or misremembering past events. Ultimately, it's a story about a woman who has a memory which she's believed for a really long time, and she has misremembered this event, and it's the impact that has had on her life as it all unravels over a 24-hour period.
Lena?
I got lost in that. I was like,
"Yeah, no, that was beautiful."
I guess it's like a Tom and Jerry of past. It's like, you know, it's a cat and mouse game of past meeting the present in sort of sickly and sweet shimmers and triggers, really.
Yeah, I mean, very profound. I thought you guys were going to do like little plot summaries, but they're all very, very fascinating films. But I'm wondering, what were the like sparks that kind of originated the stories when you were coming with them? Was there a moment where you were like the nexus of the idea started? I mean, Luna, we should start with you.
I don't know, I was not in a great headspace, so there was plenty of nexus and filth and all sorts happening in my head. I don't know, it's no synchronicity that I wrote it in like the spring of 2020 when none of us knew what was happening and we were all in a weird limbo, and to be honest, didn't want to be on planet Earth anymore, and my brain just entered the vaults of the past and the memories started to just melt in with the present, and I guess I'd just say I don't even know who wrote Horde. Like, I kind of just felt like I was the vessel that just vomited it out, and it was something that I wanted to just leave behind, and the new shopper finding it just be this disgusting thing that they couldn't believe that this nice girl who once worked in CEX, like, you know, left behind in like tied in a ribbon, but then it bloomed into something really healing and quite beautiful. But the Nexus, I guess the past and losing all my sense of smell during COVID as well, and it's very like smelly, and I don't know, definitely that sense is opened up when you read the story of Horde and hopefully watch it, but that definitely was part of it, losing one sense and gaining another, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, not only can you almost smell the film, but like, you know, when you can smell something so much, you can taste it too. Mm. Like, yeah, it's
which
that.
Is weird, because that's what happened to me during COVID. Is I could sort of taste essences of the past. Mm-hmm. Like when you smell something and you are shimmered or triggered back to the past, I've kind of lost that. I don't even have that often anymore, but I do taste it, like an essence or, you know, like coppery smells in my mouth, which is what transforms me back now.
Ben, what about you? Where did the kind of seeds of the idea for Har come from?
I actually wrote it for the lead actress, and we'd worked together on a short film, and again, it was, I mean, I think probably like lots of things that have come out over the last couple of years, it kind of grew out of COVID. It sort of grew out of a what are we going to do? Like, you know, you suddenly had this time, and then it was kind of a, well, you know, what are we going to do when it's all over? And we'd worked together on a short, and we really wanted to do something again. And she was working on a big TV show in Budapest. And so I trained as a cinematographer, and she said, "You should come over, and, you know, we should do something in Budapest because it's the light's beautiful. You'll really love being in Budapest." And we just started chatting about, I suppose, it's not really about her experiences or my experiences or anything like that, but there's kind of like a sort of common ground. There were things that I think she was going through in her life, and her friends, and, you know, that I'd sort of observed as well, you know, about my friends and being at a particular age and stage in your life, that I just sort of started writing this thing. And I also wanted to make something. So the first two films that I shot were done for a very low budget with really tiny crews, and I really missed making films like that. And it felt like, obviously, you know, with COVID kind of being such a present thing, it felt like a kind of going back and doing something in an almost documentary kind of style with a really tiny crew felt like that was possibly achievable rather than having to wrangle kind of like a large sort of crew. So we actually went out to film with six people, and the day before we started filming, the entire UK crew apart from me and the lead actress went down with COVID, We had an entire Hungarian crew who came in and replaced them literally at the 11th hour. That was kind of it sort of, I don't really know where it came from. I think it was just there were things that we wanted to explore, I think she's great, so I wrote this project for her, basically.
And you mean like it's so distinctive visually, like you shot it all on Super 8. Was that always kind of part of the concept from the beginning?
Yeah, I can't really remember where the idea to shoot on Super 8 came from exactly. I think I love shooting on film, but it was kind of, so there was a kind of there were sort of multiple there is a kind of a reason within the film for it to be shot on Super 8, I think. It's about somebody who works in the film industry, and it deals with memory and nostalgia, and obviously Super 8 has a kind of a nostalgic memory sense kind of thing. It gets used a lot for flashbacks and stuff like that. It's this kind of dreamlike thing. So that worked. But it was also, the camera was small enough that I could carry it around in a rucksack. And obviously when you've got six people, then, you know, that's kind of, if we had shot it on 16mm or 35, then you'd have needed boxes and, you know, lenses, and, you know, we'd have basically we could fit everybody in one people carrier and all of our lights and all of our, you know, all of the camera. But we also shot it on digital as well, so we actually made two films, like not at the same time. We weren't filming at the same time. We rehearsed, and then we'd shoot the digital, and then we swapped the cameras out and we shot on Super 8. So we always had a backup because the cameras were they're like 50 years old, and we went through four of them in total during the production. They just broke down. They don't like getting cold in Budapest, and Budapest in February is pretty cold. So it was a bit of a gamble, basically. Yeah.
You know, you sowed and now you're reaping.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is beautiful. And I think as well, I wanted to kind of treat it as because it's used so much for flashbacks and music videos and things like that. And it's, and, you know, and just kind of go, okay, well, what does it look like if you put it within the mechanics of a professional film shoot? You know, I mean, it's almost like Soderbergh with his, you know, with the iPhone, the stuff that he's shot on iPhones. It's almost the same approach, but kind of doing that with Super 8, which is kind of nuts, but, like, you know, it's beautiful. It's a really beautiful medium, and I think it looks good projected. I think it looks good projected.
Nakash, I mean, like, your film very much feels of the present. Mm-hmm. But, like, where did the idea for In Camera come from?
Actually, that was one of the core, like, intentions. I wanted everything to feel, like, live. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to create a film that felt like it was happening, like, right now. But, like, from shooting, working backwards, it was, like, 8 years of thinking. Like, I first had the idea 8 years ago. And I never really understand or know where ideas come from, but at the core of it, I knew I wanted to create a fairy tale. And I knew that I wanted to talk a lot about kind of the horror of, like, identity politics, mm-hmm. almost. And the core thing I had in my head was, like, if you just, like, accept everything that's projected onto you as you, like, navigate the world, what would happen to you? And I think, like, acting and, like, the role of the actor was kind of, like, the perfect metaphor for that. So I kind of just, like, knew that my lead character was going to be an actor. It was going to be a fairy tale. And I had this, like, construction of what I wanted a script to be. There was, like, a side A and a side B, and every scene was a track, and there was, like, an album, and there were these, like, interludes. So I had this, like, desired story structure and this vague kind of, like, but very clear atmosphere. And then in that time period, it was like constructing that and putting that all together.
Yeah. I mean, you have this incredible lead actor in Nabhad Rizwan. Yeah. Was it collaborative? Like, did you draw on, like, did he bring to it, like, the experiences he'd had as an actor?
Yeah, super collaborative. Like, I see every actor I work with as, like, a co-author of that character. And Nabhad and me worked together for 6 months, and we went through every single scene together. We'd have these, like, 8 to 10 hour long meetings where we would just, like, analyze the script, and he would tell me lots about his experiences, and I'd share my experiences, and I would just keep rewriting the script in, like, a responsive way, because I feel like a script should be this kind of, like, live document that you're, like, you're collaborating with all of these people, and you I always want to like write 60% of a character and I'm like looking for 40% in the other person. So yeah, we completely developed that character from like how this person was going to walk to how this person was going to talk, the silhouettes of the wardrobe. So it was super collaborative, but I mean, that's why I want to make films. Like, I love working with actors. I love that kind of collaboration. So even when there wasn't Naban, I was always kind of writing in this way where this character's kind of like a blank canvas, and I knew that I was going to kind of cast this other artist who was going to help me develop this character.
I mean, yeah, he's incredible. But I think it's been like, I was reading some stuff about the film earlier, and they talked about like how, I mean, I loved it, but smart writers make me think better, where it's like, it's almost designed for like the attention span that we've now humans have gotten into. And it's not all right for kind of the cinema to assume that it has to be how it was in like when Citizen Kane was made, because like our minds don't work in the same way. I mean, like, how did you realize that?
Yeah, no, this is something I would think about a lot. Like, I'm really excited to see films from like kids born in the 90s and 2000s, because I just think the grammar is different. Like, how we navigate the world is different. Whether that's things like the story structure of like three acts, I just don't think that's fit for purpose anymore. And like, I don't think the world is a neat way. There's no neatness to our modern lives, so art should reflect that. And I feel like everything is so present, and then we live through a series of like distractions that I wanted kind of how we all navigate the world to be like in the grammar of it. Because I think when you're making a film, you're like adding to the grammar of everything that's come before you. And I think it's really important to like question every single tool you inherit as a director and be like, is this for me? Is this my grammar? But I wanted this kind of like really like live kind of almost like ADD quality to the film, because I just feel like that's more representative of today.
Yeah. I mean, Luna, do you also kind of feel like where you actually not only want to make your own films, you actually want to kind of see the boundaries of what films should be like challenged?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I just make everything for like 14-year-old me, what I would have wanted to like illegally stream off Putlocker, or, you know, and I think, yeah, hearing you speak about it in that way is that very much our brains do not function the way that they once was, and we are literally generation, like, I don't want to say watching redacted videos on like BBM at like aged 11, like the influx of information that our brains have had in comparison to like even my sister and my parents is like, so it's no wonder we're all being diagnosed with ADD now. Like, yeah. Even myself, that like, you know, people who went to my test screening were like, God, I have ADHD, and this is the first time I've watched a film in a really long time and it feels kinetic. But that's only because it naturally is kinetic, because that is also how I just navigate the world and like experience the world, like most of us do now. But yeah, I guess, I don't know, I think I work in an unorthodox way, because I didn't go to film school, I just went straight to work. So the way that I work is just how it fits naturally to me, and how, you know, I can't write a script straight away. Like, I can't just start writing a script. I can only ever do it from prose in writing a story, first of all. And because otherwise, I'm just writing like a stream of consciousness. I can't, you know, a script to me is quite mathematical, it's quite strategic. Whereas, you know, when you're writing a story, I want to live in that stream of consciousness and just have it vomit out of me. Whereas I don't feel like I can really do that if I just write a script. So
you go back to the story when you're filming, yeah. Do you kind of chuck the script out?
No,
or do you stick rigidly with the script once it's kind of in script form?
So much of the story is just the meat of the script plus extra dialogue. But it's weird, like when I got to the sort of like the last part of filming my film, like just for like a sort of emotional exorcism in a way, which makes sense to my film, is that I did go back and read the story just for myself, and I actually gave it to my lead actress Sarah, and we read it together, because she actually only ever got, she only had the beginning of the script anyway, she never knew where the story was going. Mm-hmm. So we sort of sat down together like before the sort of last couple of days and read through the story, and I don't know, just to travel the essence of that back into where we were, well, where I was in script. She had no idea where she was half the time. But yeah, I don't know. I think I kind of wish everyone got to make a film at like age 25, like conscription service. Like, you have to make a film, because we would just have so many different kinds of formulas of filmmaking and so many exciting stories. But yeah, can't remember how I got from A to B, but Yeah.
But we're glad you did.
Here I am, vomit.
Like, both in terms of being at LFF and in terms of, like, the other stuff that you're seeing at LFF, like, what, like, Ben, what does it mean to you to be here? And then also, is there anything that you've seen that has been inspiring?
Well, I mean, I mean this quite genuinely, and I'm not blowing smoke up anybody's ass here, but, like, actually sitting here listening to you two just saying what you just said about, like, I'd not thought about it. I mean, I don't know how old you both are, but I'm probably 10 years older than you. And, like, so, and as I said, my growing up experience was so, you know, it is sort of formed in those sort of 40s and 50s and 60s and stuff like that. So it's actually, like, and, you know, so I sort of, yeah, God, maybe I need to start watching stuff on, like, you know, more stuff on TikTok and, like, you know, to try and find a new language. I think, to answer your question, LFF is amazing. It's brilliant being here. I mean, it's I've been coming to the festival since 2007, and it's always. I mean, I'm not from London. I'm from Yorkshire originally, but you know, I've been living here since 2007 on and off, and so it feels incredible to be in this festival amongst, like, all of the films, like, filmmakers that I've looked up to for years, and it's just mad. I mean, it's like I'm still in a state of shock, I think. And I think we're in a really, you know, it's been a really difficult couple of years. You know, you've had COVID, and then with the strikes this year, which are, you know, hugely important, and you know, what they're fighting for and what the crews are fighting for as well. It's like, you know, it feels like there's this huge sort of seismic shift going on, and but it's been, like, what an amazing year for British cinema. Like, it kind of feels like we're sort of going through this boom period, and, like, I hope that kind of continues, and it feels like some of the rule books need to be sort of torn up, and we need to think about different ways of getting out there and making stuff, I suppose. But I think it's really exciting. Like, I think we're in an exciting period, and, you know, right now, and hopefully once the politics have kind of sorted themselves out a bit more, then it'll be even more exciting, right? I mean, I don't know. What do you guys think? Like, do you feel like it's a good period, or do you think we're about to hit a brick wall?
I feel like not enough people talk about, like, how young cinema is as a medium. Mm-hmm. Like, we should be breaking it. We should be trying things. Yeah. And sometimes it's not always going to work, but, like, it's... I love going to see a film and being like, whoa, I didn't know you could do that. And I think I'm always chasing that feeling of, like, to me, like, it's always, like, the desire to, like, articulate something inarticulate. And that is a trial and error thing that you have to try to communicate things in different ways. So I think what's going on right now is, like, people are trying to rework and figure out what the grammar of filmmaking is, just as we're trying to figure out what modern life is. And that's, yeah, how it should be, though. It's like...
Yeah, I remember being at a panel last year, and Michael Winterbottom had basically used his COVID lockdown period to interview a bunch of filmmakers and, you know, sort of analyse the films and talk about the difficulties of making your first film and moving on to your second film or your third film or your fourth film or whatever, and particularly with a focus in the UK. And I remember one of the guys on the panel was saying that, like, actually what he almost wants to be able to do is, like, go out and shoot something, come back, test it out, see if it works, go out, shoot something else, like, develop a little bit more, like, that it's... So maybe it's the form, the way that films are made needs to be kind of rethought as much as the actual stories themselves, that there's a different kind of way of kind of going out and exploring rather than kind of presenting something as, like, a finance kind of package that, right, well, there's the film that you're going to end up with. You know, that it's kind of more exploratory, because as you move through the different stages of, like, film production, like, the ideas change and they shift and they morph, right? And they kind of, you know, but I don't know. I mean, maybe that's too...
That's utopian.
Well, yeah, it is. It's completely utopian, but, you know.
I would adore that, but I don't see that happening. I don't see that happening unless you are Michael Winterbottom.
Yeah, well...
Well, maybe you are the next Michael Winterbottom. I mean, like, Horde is an incredible film. I mean, you were in Venice, now you're at LFF. You're kind of coming into this festival with kind of the wind in your sails. Like, you know, you're a little bit on a victory lap. Do you feel that coming into this festival?
I don't know. It's all been quite surreal. I don't feel like I've hit the ground yet. It's all been quite I think because we're such a family, like the film is such a family, like my cast and crew, literally from my paramedic on set to, you know, my cast, and that it always felt really mellow. Like even being in Venice just felt like I was just going out to dinner with my family, and just not, it didn't ever feel like, it feels surreal that people are witnessing it for themselves, but it feels quite mellow in the way that we're all so connected that, you know, like I was with my cast earlier and went to see Bike Riders, and just feels like a little family that I just want. I want my like little Fassbinder like circus that I pull and push people in and out and rotate them, and that we can all just experience this thing together. And I think that's all you ever have from making a film, is the experience of making the film. It doesn't matter what that film, if it's good or bad, all you ever have, like when you're on that deathbed, is that experience. And my experience was as powerful as I hope, you know, when people feel the film that we made together, and yeah, joint vomited together. Yeah.
Well, I mean, thank the three of you so much for your films and also for being here today. This was awesome. Your work is very exciting in a kind of year of cursed strikes and, you know, AI dominance. This gives me hope for the future. A round of applause for Luna Kamoun, Ben Hecking, and Nicole Perry.
Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth in Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Hannah Strong and David Jenkins, as well as the filmmakers Luna Kamoun, Ben Hecking, and Nikash Hadid. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.